Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I was young when I left home, caught up in out of rambling round, and I never wrote a letter to my home, to my home, Lord, to my home, and I never wrote a letter to my home.
This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and online at WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. Last month saw the release of No Direction Home, Martin Scorsese's nearly four-hour documentary about the first six momentous years of Bob Dylan's career when he outraged fans and folk purists by going electric. The film ran on public television last month and is also available on DVD. And as you've probably heard by now, there's also a companion two-disc soundtrack to the film, which boasts 26 rare and unreleased tracks like this home recording you're hearing in the background. Joining us from Boston today with his review is Tim Riley, author of Hard Rain, a Dylan Commentary, and numerous other books. His latest is Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. Tim, welcome back.
Hi, good to be here.
So the score, I mean, it's amazing, first of all, how long a shadow Dylan continues to cast over the music scene. And in fact, virtually every segment of our program today will have some kind of a Dylan component to it, as we'll hear. But let's start with this Scorsese film. What was it that seems to have really captured people's attention and imagination in the Scorsese documentary?
Well, first of all, Scorsese, you know, is renowned for being one of the very few directors who has risen to the level that he's gotten to, in large part because he has this great sympathetic feeling for how music can work well in movies and how it can convey something beyond what the characters are thinking and feeling through the dialogue. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you think of Martin Scorsese, I mean, when I think of Martin Scorsese, I think of that scene in Mean Streets where they all start to gather at the bar, Robert De Niro, and the soundtrack is playing the Ronettes' "Be My Baby,"
yeah.
And it's this very heavy, you know, macho scene that we're getting drawn into with these characters. But it's this girl group material, and it's the absolute perfect piece of material to play for this scene. And of course, Scorsese also did The Last Waltz, which is the first time that he featured Dylan in a movie. And all of his movies have this great sense of how rock and roll can be used in ways that just nobody else has figured out how to do, except for maybe Quentin Tarantino. And so this marriage of Scorsese to this Dylan project is really, you know, an ideal sort of setup. And Scorsese came to this project late. He did not do any of the interviews. He inherited a lot of this footage from stuff that had started to be collected in the late 90s. In fact, Allen Ginsberg is prominent in the movie. He died in 1997. So Scorsese gives it this kind of formal frame and this nice shape. And this, he just doesn't fall into any of the traps that you get from your run-of-the-mill musical biographies in this form. You know, he doesn't have a lot of talking over performance sequences, for example. So you get Dylan performing, and you get like a whole song, and it's very satisfying, and it's very dramatic. And when he does cutaways to people talking, it's always very directly relevant to what's going on in the song. And it's just a very sort of seamless, natural kind of narrative that frames the music just beautifully, puts it in a larger context.
For me, the most impressive thing was just having the opportunity to hear Dylan himself at such length. I mean, the guy is, you know, not the most voluble musician in the world, at least not when it comes to speaking, and especially when it comes to speaking about himself. But as you say, that those interviews, Dylan had sat for those interviews prior to Scorsese coming on board. What was Scorsese himself able to get some previously unseen footage from archives, from performances, digging stuff up that, you know, he only was able to access?
Well, no, it was more that Dylan's management had had this project in mind, and they had a lot of footage that they had shot, especially during the 1966 rock and roll tour of Britain, which is the, you know, what the widely regarded as this great electric rock and roll tour that has come out previously as a Live in 66 as part of the same bootleg series. And a lot of the stage footage was captured for a projected ABC television special. But
back in the 60s.
Back in the 60s. And they had all this footage, but the way it was cut for something that that wound up getting called Eat the Document, which has circulated in bootleg circles for a long time. But Eat the Document is like the worst example of, you know, someone who's taken too many drugs in the editing room and really can't put together a cohesive narrative and can't make sense of all this footage they have. What's really sort of shocking to those of us Dylan scholars who knew all this stuff was out there was just how pristine it's actually been being presented in here in Scorsese's hands. And it's been remastered. It's beautifully lit, and the sound is great. And Dylan performing this stuff with an electric band, it's absolutely captivating. It's really some very stunning stage footage that he's acquired. And it's never been cut with the same kind of attention to detail. And you know, Scorsese just really he knew what to do with this raw material.
Right. But it was Dylan's management that had originally made had the film done in the first place.
Right. Well, you know, my view on it is that just as Scorsese is able to put Dylan in this larger sort of cultural context as the folkie who comes to New York and idolizes Woody Guthrie, and there's all of this folk lineage that's mm-hmm. talked about and discussed there. But, I mean, what Dylan is doing now, I mean, Dylan's latest sort of guise, the latest mask that he's put on for us, is as his own librarian. I mean, he has made a decision that this early period is really important and that it contains a lot of his very best work. Mm-hmm. And by focusing on 61 to 66, he's able to say, you know, this is really a precious phase of my career, and I really want to make sure that we get this phase done right.
All right. So, Tim, first of all, let me remind our audience that we will be taking calls in the second segment of Soundcheck this afternoon. So do stay with us and perhaps join us on the air in a little bit. But, Tim, to what extent do you think Dylan himself has been engineering this whole thing, both the Scorsese documentary and this accompanying 2-CD set?
Well, you never know. I mean, I think he sort of what he does is he says, you know, all right, well, I'll give you license to deal with this material. Let's see what you come up with. And then they come back and present it to him, and they say, well, can we release it like this? And I don't know what that process is like. I mean, he might say, well, this is good, but I want to add X, Y, and Z in here, or, you know, we got to make sure we interview this person here. I don't know what, you know, how much of a hand he has in it. I think he basically just, you know, is nearing the end of his long career and of his long life, and he's saying, you know, this material is precious to me. I want to make sure this is preserved in a respectable form.
Hmm. So the CD, which is called No Direction Home, the soundtrack, actually goes all the way back to before Dylan came to New York. I mean, the CD begins with a recording made by a high school friend. And I guess, Tim, this must be one of the earliest recordings of Dylan that we have anywhere.
I think it's probably the earliest known Dylan recording that's come to light so far. And there's this wonderful sequence in the documentary where the school teacher talks about it, you know, Dylan taking the stage and having this rock band behind him. Again, it's part of what puts this whole Dylan experience in perspective. He was not just a folkie. He was playing rock and roll long before he joined the folk scene.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear this music, and the song is apparently an original song, When I Got Troubles, and it's from 1959, and the school is so shocked by the sound of this, and it's so weird that they close the curtains on him. But that's that's the audience's first reaction to hearing Dylan as a high school performer, is that the principal just yanks the curtain. You know, they get the hook out for him.
Here's Bob Dylan, circa 1959.
Well, I'm gonna forget my trouble. Leave my trouble behind. I'm going to swing it up, swing down. Grab the paper down. Wham, 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 wham. Swing your trouble. Swing your trouble.
is a very young Bob Dylan, recorded in 1959 in high school. A high school friend made the tape. When I Got Troubles is now on the new 2-CD set called No Direction Home, the soundtrack. Lots of music that made it into the Scorsese documentary and lots of music that didn't. So there's a lot here. We're speaking with Tim Riley, author of numerous books, including Hard Rain, a Dylan commentary, and his latest, Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. And, Tim, we're going to take a quick break with one of Dylan's most famous songs, Like a Rolling Stone, which is also on this CD set. And we'll come back to you in a couple of minutes.
Thank you.
And we'll also be coming to you folks for a call-in segment on the influence of Bob Dylan. And, you know, why do we want all of the outtakes and the live versions and the demos and the alternate takes? Do we want all of that stuff? We'd like to hear your opinion. That's coming up in just a couple of minutes on Soundcheck.
You must leave now, take what you need, you think will last. But whatever you wish to keep, you'd better grab it fast.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and my guest is Tim Riley, author of, among many other books, Hard Rain, a Dylan commentary. And we're talking about Bob Dylan, but specifically about the recently screened Martin Scorsese film, which was on public TV last month and is now out on DVD, and the companion 2-CD set called No Direction Home, the soundtrack. Tim, I'm going to ask you this question, and then I'm going to throw it out to our listeners as well. So just give me a moment before you actually answer it, but the question is, why do we want all of the home recordings and the alternate versions and the live recordings? You know, what do you get out of having all this other stuff when there's already such a large and important body of work out there? Now, let me give our phone number. It's 212-264-7483. This is not our, you know, on-air membership number. This is the call-in number. So if you want to answer that question or just make a comment about Dylan in general, 212-264-7483. So, Tim, what do we get from all of this additional stuff?
Well, a lot of different things. You know, Dylan is renowned for being a very interesting person to perform with because he likes to throw curveballs to all the musicians that he takes the stage with. I mean, there's many stories of them rehearsing certain songs at a certain tempo in a certain key, and they get to the stage, and he counts it off in a completely different tempo, and he starts playing in a new key.
Uh-huh.
And this is simply just to keep things lively and spontaneous and to really just, you know, I want to keep you guys on your toes, and I want you all, like, figuring out that you had better pay attention to me and what I'm doing as you play the song, because I might take it in directions that you've never heard before.
Mm.
And this is part of Dylan's, artistry, really, is that he's like this ever-revolving prism. You know, he never sings a song the same way twice. And that's why when we have an outtake of a Dylan song, you'll often hear it at a different tempo, or he'll sing a lyric a little bit differently, or he'll give it a new inflection, a new emphasis. And, you know, for him, it's never really standing still. It's not a static thing. A song is a very organic thing to him. It's always evolving through time, and it's always catching different aspects of the light that interest him as it goes along, and he wants that to be reflected among his players, too.
Mm.
I mean, there's a fascinating thing about the recording session for Like a Rolling Stone, which is, you know, the subject of a new book by Greil Marcus, which is, you know, a whole book devoted to this single track, which is that one of the fascinating things about that recording is that the musicians themselves are catching on to the lyrics as they hear them for the first or second time. And you can hear them hit the groove harder during each pass at the refrain.
Mm-hmm.
And as each verse builds up to each refrain, you can hear they are gaining on the song. And they're getting a much deeper and richer sense of how dense the poetry is as it goes by. And that's a very clever thing to do to a set of, you know,
Fairly simple chord changes.
Yeah, simple chord changes, but also very well-established studio musicians who are used to rolling in and laying down tracks and doing it really, you know, without much thought. This really forces them to do some listening as they play, and it makes the whole recording, you know, from beginning to end, intensely dynamic. Huh. That is, at any particular moment, you're gonna hear things that are accidental, but actually, you know, particularly relevant to the words that are passing by. And that makes it a fascinating recording.
All right. Let's take some calls, Tim, from our listeners. And, you know, if you picked up the guitar back in 1969 because of the influence of Bob Dylan, let us know. Give us a call at 212-264-7483. In a short while, we'll be hearing from singer-songwriter Robin Hitchcock, who did just that. And he'll be giving us a musical reminiscence of Bob Dylan as we continue with Soundcheck. But for the moment, let's start with John in Westchester. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks.
So
I want to know if Tim had any insights as to what could make someone like Dylan so prolific and be able to produce so creatively for decades when most artists are lucky to go a year or two or maybe 10.
Yeah, it's a very interesting feature of Dylan's talent is that he is so prolific, and he seems to churn out song after song after song, and so many in this golden period or the early period. There's sort of two parts to this early period. One is 61 to 66, where he's sort of, you know, mastering folk and then moving on to rock and roll. And then a second period between, say, I would say between 66 and 75 or 76 that ends with about Desire, where he's sort of using a lot of those same tools in very different ways and experimenting with a lot of different aspects of folk and the roots of American music and different aspects of rock and roll. And, you know, I don't really – you don't have an explanation for it. I mean, every artist is different. I mean, some artists, you know, they cough up six songs in a whole lifetime, and they're really good songs, but that's just all they have in them. Dylan, you know, has multitudes in him. I mean, he's just got, like, a huge amount of interesting things to say, of interesting perspectives on a lot of different things. And I think it's important to remember that it's not – I mean, it's one measure of an artist, but one of the things that this documentary doesn't really do is address – you know, all of the bad songs that he's written.
And well, that sort of comes with the territory when you're prolific, right?
Well, it does with some artists and it doesn't with other artists. I mean, I think it would be – you'd be hard-pressed to say now, you know – the ratio of good to bad with Dylan is kind of, you know, it's kind of a lot more lopsided than it was when we looked at it in 1976. It's just, I mean, the stuff that's come since 76, I just think is a lot weaker than the stuff that's come before. Hmm. Whereas someone like Bruce Springsteen, for example, the ratio of good to bad is much richer, much more dynamic. I mean, he really does seem to do a better job of editing out some of the weaker stuff.
Yeah.
And so it's a problem that you look at as a critic because you want to do the really good stuff justice. So you want to measure what's truly great and then try and do reasonable assessments of some of the other stuff.
All right, John, thanks very much for the call, getting us started with calls on Soundcheck. Let's move right along to Tony from Queens. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I disagree with that other caller. I don't think anything Dylan did is bad. I think you just don't
realize. So you're actually, I'm sorry, Tony, you're disagreeing with Tim, not the caller. The caller said he was prolific. Tim's the one saying there were some bad songs. So.
I wouldn't compare. Springsteen is nothing compared to Dylan. He's very small. Dylan is a giant.
Tim?
Yeah, I just think we disagree. I think they're giants in very different worlds. I mean, there's, you know, Dylan is interested in very different kind of thematic
He's
material
greater than
Springsteen is.
Springsteen. He inspired Springsteen.
I think Springsteen would agree with you on that. I think even Dylan would agree with you
Anybody
on that. But
would
I don't
agree. Do you realize
I don't think
Dylan
I would agree with you on that.
Has been alive way longer than Springsteen. He's worshipped all over the world. Worship.
Well, because he's a rock star. You know, I mean, we're talking about a couple of different things. You know, we're talking, I guess, Tim, the thing to mention here is that while Dylan had his kind of electric period, he didn't really embrace the whole arena rock thing the way Springsteen did.
And so no.
We're talking about, you know, kind of we're talking about, if not apples and oranges, we're talking about oranges and tangerines.
Well, in my mind, it's a little bit oranges and tangerines. It's like you have two different songwriters, and yeah, I mean, Dylan inspired Springsteen, no question about it. Springsteen inducts him into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with a really interesting speech. But to say Dylan is greater, I think that is kind of an aesthetic judgment I can't quite get with. I mean,
right.
Are the Rolling Stones better than the Beatles? Or you know,
right,
I mean,
exactly.
I mean, you can have that argument, but where does it get you really? I mean, they really do occupy different worlds of feeling, of ideas, and that's not a very interesting argument in my mind.
All right, let's see if we can get something interesting from Kenny, who's in Piscataway, New Jersey. Hi, Kenny.
Hey, how you guys doing?
All right.
I'd say I'm 45. I grew up listening to Dylan, but never was really a huge fan until I actually listened to Scorsese's documentary or watched it on TV. And I'm a guitar player, so I play almost every day. And I couldn't believe I was really interested in how Dylan was like at the heart of the civil rights movement, and there with the Martin Luther King "I Have a Dream" speech. He was there in D.C. at that time, and he really struck me. I have a genuine like good feeling for Dylan now because it seems like he was really there and he is genuine. That's what the documentary actually showed me.
Hmm. All right.
I really never had any idea of his history.
Yeah.
And,
it speaks to Dylan's turnaround at that moment because he ran so fast and so hard from that folky ethic that I think it's really one of the key reasons he wanted this documentary out was to remind people, because it's not remarked on very much in many of the Dylan books, that he was at the March on Washington, that he stood next to Martin Luther King when he gave that speech, and that he sang songs at that rally. And that was a very key piece of his persona in the folky world. And people have largely forgotten that. I think it's very notable that Dylan makes sure that is in the documentary.
I think, Tim, as Kenny points out, when he mentions his age, 45, it's not that people have forgotten. Some people weren't around to remember it in the first place, and so there's a whole generation just learning about this stuff. So we've been speaking with some of you on the phone and with Tim Riley, whose most recent book is Fever: How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. He's also the author of Hard Rain, a Dylan commentary. And Tim, thanks so much for joining us once again this afternoon on Soundcheck.
My pleasure, John.
In just a couple of minutes, musical reminiscence of the influence of Bob Dylan, courtesy of songwriter Robin Hitchcock. This is Soundcheck.